Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Well, friends, and you are my friends, because this is my show, and I'm going to pick top priority on what to discuss first. And yeah, I know the biggest movie of the summer this month, this week, is out now in April. However, more importantly for me, and I saw the movie after last week's show, and I think I told you I was going to, I did tell you I was going to discuss it on this week's show. And I'm really excited to see that it's going to play for another week in Indianapolis. And I implore you, the movie going crowd, if you are a fan of cinema, if you are a fan of music, and especially if you're a fan of gospel music, if you're a fan of Aretha Franklin, you owe it to yourself to experience in the theater the gospel concert documentary Amazing Grace. And there's quite the story behind this, which I hope when this film comes out on video, dear Criterion, there should be a slew of documentaries and supplements to go with it, because the story behind it is just as fascinating for me. Of course, this is a live recording of what would be Aretha's gospel album, Amazing Grace, at the height of her power, at the height of her popularity at Atlantic Records. She told Atlantic Records she was going to record a gospel album. And it turns out to be not only the biggest selling album of her discography, but the biggest live gospel recording ever sold to this day, 40 plus years later. So they were going to film this in a church in Watts with a choir behind her. And the Reverend Cleveland is a music director, or I'd say piano, and accompanying her. Her father even makes an appearance. Director Sidney Pollack, Indiana's own Sidney Pollack. This was going to be his follow-up to They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And this was the film, this is the thing he shot before Jeremiah Johnson. So the story is they filmed it, and the film and the sound did not sync up. So Warner Brothers shelved the movie. And by the way, I read, according to Wikipedia, so take it for what it's worth, Warner Brothers wanted to release this on a double feature with Superfly. Now, I don't know, the church people wanted to see Superfly, and I didn't know if the, well, it hadn't been coined blaxploitation yet, were going to want to go see a gospel movie. I think Warner Brothers just put them together because they were black movies, you know, that they, some executives thought that back then. Anyway, the film was shelved, but through the power of technology, they were able to finally restore and sync up the visuals and the music. And for some reason, that's, and this is the big mystery, Aretha didn't want the film released. In fact, near the end of her life, when some film festivals were going to show the film, she sent her lawyers out with papers to asking them to not air the film. So for that, and I still haven't figured out and or found out why she didn't want this released, because it's a marvelous, marvelous film. Early reports came out that critics were lumping this in the same pantheon of great concert documentaries like The Last Waltz and Gimme Shelter and Stop Making Sense. And after experiencing it, I agree with them. It's bare bones photography. There's several, because you're filming inside a church as it's going on. There was two nights that they did this recording. So you have the aisles, you have around the altar area and around the musicians, and a wonderful choir, great faces. And I think there was one ladder, and that was it. So it's bare bones. It's a lot of, and I think because it's a 70s filmmaking, not a whole lot of editing. I'm going to be curmudgeonly and talk about the post Moulin Rouge MTV editing that plagues a lot of music videos today. All you need is a camera and these great voices, and especially Aretha. There's those wonderful little moments of when the camera's coming in and you're like, oh, it's got to come in the focus. And of course it does. And you see this beautiful face drenched in sweat, eyes closed, singing her heart out. Just being one of the most powerful vocalists of any genre of music on the planet. There's that, and I'm usually not a fan of audience shots. I don't think they're necessarily needed. Neil Young, I love the fact that Neil Young's concert films don't have those. Thank you, Jonathan Demme. But there's still moments of seeing folks enthralled with what they're hearing on stage. And there are even one person who just looks dead into the camera and cannot believe that they're having such a good time. Again, bare bones photography. You see cameramen going in and out from behind. It's amusing to watch a young, well then young, Sidney Pollack clapping along to the music or pointing to the cameraman to shoot something else. If you look carefully, there's a cameo by Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts, who both attended one of the evening's performances. So it's just a great evening of music, and kudos to technology for putting this film finally together. For me, it's the first important film of 2019. 47 years after the fact. So, like I said, it has a second weekend in Indianapolis. I know we live in a opening weekend oriented society now when it comes to our movies, and when I saw it at 2 o'clock on a Saturday, last Saturday, I was impressed with the number of people that were there. I would say probably 3/4 full, and I know I brought the age average down a little bit with my presence, but no, it's a marvelous, marvelous piece of cinema and music combined. So please go see this, and you can read my write up about this in the Film Yap, which Chris Lloyd was able to put out last week. That was another one of those. I saw it. My shift normally starts at 5 here at the station on Saturdays. I came straight here and started writing and sent it out, and it was published on the Film Yap Saturday evening. So that is out there. I'm more excited to tell you about that than the Avengers. And, yeah, I know. I can hear your eyes roll. Here's the thing, what bugged me about the last film, and I'm going to be a nice person and not give away stuff if you've not seen the last Avengers film. What bugged me about that film, it does get wrapped up in this film, and I wondered why they couldn't have done it earlier. I'll give a case in point. Certain characters go away, and I know they're coming back. I guess that's the big thing. I couldn't believe at the last Avengers film how many people, especially people my age, were just gasping. Maybe I'm not the biggest superhero fan, or I'm not even a superhero fan compared to others. What has bothered me about the series, and it's all on me really, is The films individually are good. I think I've only missed 2 of the 21 Marvel films, and I'm hoping to correct that this summer. But they're individually fine. It just feels like a cinematic chore having to cover all of these worlds together. And the last film felt like a disaster movie. The old 70s movies were the little squares, little rectangles at the bottom of the screen. at the bottom of the poster with the actors on it. I remember Roger Ebert said, if your poster has that, beware of the film. You know, everybody got six lines, and it was a stepping stone for this film. So with Endgame, it proved you could have made an Avengers movie 3 hours long a long time ago. If it's good, like this one is, it's just... I'm going to watch that. So when it comes to this one, as far as wrapping things up, because this is the curtain on a particular generation of the Marvel characters. There we go. There is a use of time travel that they wind up poking fun of. And I remember not liking how self-aware the horror movie Scream was. And it's kind of similar in this case with Endgame, but it works. I also liked the use of past and present. You know, you see some major characters coming face to face with their past, with the time travel. And we, of course, get a really too long fight scene that's just as long, if not longer, than the last Avengers film. And everybody gets a moment. Everybody, of course, gets a moment. And all nine endings wrap up faster than Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. So, but the small moments, the intimate moments for such a long and at times loud film, I like those. So, yeah, I'm going to recommend it. And I'll let everybody up front be cheery and yelly and screamy, and I'll just be back here saying, okay, now can we go back to the movies? And I know there's going to be more Marvel movies. Of course, Spider-Man's coming up soon. And we know certain characters and certain actors are retiring from the series. So it's a decent bow. I'm just not as wrapped up about it as other people. So there you go. That's that. And it's going to make a kajillion dollars. All right, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. New on DVD and Blu-ray this week, we've got a few titles. We have, and this is one that not enough people got to see, the Nicole Kidman cop thriller Destroyer. Yes, Nicole Kidman is a burnt-out cop in which a case from her past comes back to haunt her, and she's trying to make peace as a mother and trying to make peace as a police officer. So, yeah, you could say it's when it comes to corrupt cops, it's her Training Day or Dark Blue. But she pulls it off. She's, you know, I think a lot of people didn't like the idea of a woman as glamorous as Nicole Kidman being able to play a police officer in Los Angeles. And she pulls it off. It's a good little, I'd say this to Kobe and Mike, it's a good little potboiler. So go check that out. Criterion has released Elia Kazan's A Face in the Crowd from 1957. I enjoy bringing this up, especially if you were fans of the Andy Griffith Show, because people's heads turn when they see, this is my favorite Andy Griffith performance, as a folk singing drifter who becomes a huge media, TV, and radio star. This was made in 1957, just as relevant today as it was then. That's what makes cinema great. Period. Andy Griffith, Patricia Neal, Lee Remick, Walter Matthau. It's on Criterion. Go check that out. We'll get to a couple other video titles in a little bit. But first, at IU Cinema, Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m., Waking Ned Divine. At 10 p.m., from 2019, as a part of the International Art House Series, Birds of Passage. Saturday, April 27th, Supamoto at 4 o'clock. At 7 p.m., the Spring 2019 Student Film Showcase Montage, a celebration of moving pictures. That's at 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 27th. Sunday, the 28th, Pressing On, the Letterpress Film at 1 o'clock, the documentary from 2016. And directors Aaron Beckloff and Andrew P. Quinn are scheduled to be present for that. And then Sunday, April 28th, at 4 o'clock, National Theater Live of Antony and Cleopatra. Monday the 29th, Birds of Passage will be run again at 7 o'clock. Tuesday the 30th, Wednesday, May 1st, both at 7 p.m., the 2019 thriller Dogman. Saturday, May 11th at noon, The Human Condition, a 9.5 hour, well, let's say eight hour or so film. Starting at noon, it's going to get out about 9:30. There will be a 45-minute break, 5 hours in the screening for a meal break, and food truck services will be available outside IU Cinema from 5 to 6. So that's happening Saturday the 11th. At the Historic Artcraft Theater in Franklin, Friday, April 26th at 7:30 p.m., Mean Girls. On the 27th at 11 and 2 p.m., Cartoons for Cans. That's showing old Warner Brothers cartoons, and you bring in a canned or non-perishable food item. Blazing Saddles is sold out on the 27th that evening. Thursday, May 2nd at 7:30 p.m., the original Blob, The Blob, the one with Steve McQueen. That is happening at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin. And, of course, mark your calendars. Indie Film Fest is happening May 2nd at Newfields, and that's running May 2nd through the 12th. So you can go to indiefilmfest.org for more information. I'm hoping to have somebody from the film festival on next week's program. Okay, some older titles worth talking about, catching up on some films. I got this on DVD as a double feature, and at first I thought, well, these are not, well, I thought two blaxploitation films. However, they have something else in common. The same director, Englishman Robert Hartford Davis, directed these two films together within a span of 2 years, but they're now available on one Blu-ray. From 1974, The Take, starring Billy Dee Williams as a police lieutenant from San Francisco who is relocated to Paloma, New Mexico to crack down on organized crime in the small New Mexican haven. And we know that there's a problem because there is a daring, albeit cinematically silly, breakout during a courtroom appearance, a courtroom hearing. Very 70s cast. Eddie Albert is your police chief. Tracy Reed is a woman from his past. The bad businessman played by Vic Morrow. Sorrel Burke, yes, Boss Hogg, as an accountant hired by Billy Dee. Frankie Avalon shows up and disappears quickly as a small-time thug. And of course, the obligatory car chase with some continuity issues. And lots of open shirts of Billy Dee in 1974. Also on this collection from 2 years ago, 2 years prior, from 1972, Black Gun, starring Jim Brown, Martin Landau, Bruce Glover, Deacon Jones has a cameo, and this is one of the sillier, fun, bad blaxploitation films. And, of course, as I say blaxploitation, Fred Williamson said, "Who's getting exploited? My check's cleared." Vita Blue has an appearance in this film, and I'm going to get to that in a little bit. But the story is Jim Brown plays a club owner who goes by the name Gun, two N's, of course, and his brother is involved with a group called the Black Action Group. It's based on, you know. But his brother is a part of a heist of a betting parlor, of course, with mob ties. And one of the links to this organization is car salesman Martin Landau. And it's fun to watch Martin do live TV commercials as a car salesman in this. Gunn's brother pulls him into this web of intrigue. The two athletes that are in this, I'm sorry, three athletes, of course, Jim Brown, but Deacon Jones shows up first, and it's fun watching charismatic Jim Brown. It's like emoting Jim Brown or frolicking Jim Brown for you fans of Black Dynamite. But him going from table to table, and then what felt like an improvised scene with Deacon Jones, and Gunn asked Deacon how San Diego. This is right when Deacon Jones was traded from the Colts to the Chargers, and Deacon Jones described San Diego as a groovy place. So, yeah, but Vita Blue has one scene as a parking lot owner, guy who runs a parking lot, and his name is Sam Green. And in the credits, Vita Blue gets a credit that's boxed and an introduction credit. It owns the biggest parking lot in town, and there's one scene where he's hassled by Bruce Glover, who plays one of the lackeys in this organized mob. So, oh, and I'm sorry, Bernie Casey also shows up. So there's four athletes. It's just and Vida Blue gets a higher credit. He gets the introduction credit, and then in the closing credits gets a higher place in the closing credits than higher than Bernie Casey, higher than Glover. It's oh my God, but it's so there's that. There's the car chase. You know, you have your 70s car chases and fight scenes, and there's one where there's a fight that's so intense that it rips Jim Brown's shirt off. And by the way, Jim Brown's fight double is smaller than Jim. There's a scene with Bruce Glover and him their characters having a fight. And after a love scene, his girlfriend says to Gunn, "You made love to me beautifully." I know we've all said that. It's just a fun, silly car chase, and you know, if you interrogate a guy, then you throw him down a lane of a bowling alley. This is one I want to show friends. So yeah, Andy and Amy, you might be watching this. Also out. Oh, and same costume designer did both of these films. So a lot of open shirts for both guys. So there is that if you're into that. Also out on DVD and Blu-ray, courtesy of Film Movement, a Danish film called The Charmer. And it's a story of a young man named Ismail who originally is from Iran. And he's trying to find a woman so he can stay in the country. And you see a very, very disturbing opening scene, and that scene comes back to haunt him as the film goes on. A guy who's a mover sends money to his family in Iran, trying to find a girl, and he actually winds up meeting an Iranian woman whose family lives in Denmark, and there seems to be some sparks, even though she knows exactly what he's looking for. It's a good film, and even when the last third becomes pretty predictable on what's going to happen, what should happen, you're still engaged in watching this guy trying to survive. So yeah, it's a good one. Also out on video from Italy is a film called Cam Girl, and where you have to be careful with advertising. So a group of women get together and they're going to form their own live action internet where you're a cam girl, where you communicate with men. Do I have to explain this? This film on the cover has four beautiful women in various lingerie outfits. And it looks like it could be, you know, borderline porn. And while there is some scenes of the women working, it also shows the downside of getting lawyers and trying to keep payments and what happens if you don't, you know, what happens if you're on page 5 of Google instead of page 1. So it does show the downside of this, unruly customers. What happens if a customer follows you? What happens if one of your employees winds up dating one of your clients? So not as titillating as one thinks, although there are those moments, but a kind of a cautionary tale into a very specific world. And finally, out on DVD and Blu-ray in the Film Movement Classics from 1994, a restored version of the Italian film Farinelli. This was the Golden Globe winner for Best Foreign Film, and it was an Academy Award nominee for Best Foreign Film, about the famous opera singer who was castrated at birth, and about him and his composer brother and how they do everything together. In fact, they come as a package deal when it comes to music and women. Jerome Crabb, one of my all-time favorite That Guys, has a moment as composer, has a few scenes as composer Handel, who he's not quite the Salieri of this film because, well, we know Handel's work. There was one critique, one of the quotes that they pulled up, and I understand why they pulled the quote, to say this film does for this character with this musician what Amadeus did for Mozart, and there is. you know, there's a bit of that where he was a rock star. He was self-destructive. When he became famous, he became more difficult to work with. But it is all, on top of that, you also have a brother tale. And as the film goes on, you also find out a fairly dark secret involving one of the brothers. But you also get we see scenes of opera singer as rock star, a woman talking about having a musical orgasm by listening to him. You see the women swooning in the audience with these really extremely high notes. But it's a gorgeous looking film. I mean, production value, costumes. If you're into opera, you'll dig this. And it's slightly more than, it's not just the Amadeus of opera. It's a little more than that with the brother tale. So, and you got your own crab. So, yeah, Farinelli out on Classic Film Movement Classic DVD and Blu-ray. All right, I want to get to Dead People We Like because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like. Terry Rawlings, best known as the film editor for Alien, Blade Runner, and Chariots of Fire, died this week at the age of 85. I'm hot scrawling here at Film Sociology, was nominated for one Oscar for his editing of Chariots of Fire from 1981. Did also a lot of worked in the sound department before he got into editing. So if you enjoyed the sound of films like, dubbing editor from 1967's Bedazzled. I'll never forget What's His Name, the Oliver Reed film from 67. Dubbing editor for Women in Love, if you want to watch Alan Bates and Oliver Reed wrestle naked. That's the Ken Russell film. Also out on Criterion, by the way. You should get that. Also dubbing editor on The Music Lovers, the other Ken Russell film that's most of his films were bat spit crazy. Also was dubbing editor on Ken Russell's The Devils, the film Lawman, the Burt Lancaster Western from the early 70s, that's really good. The Nightcomers, Shadow's Land, The Mechanic, Scorpio, The Stone Killer, sound editor on The Great Gatsby, The Gambler, Listomania, Juan Tonton, The Dog Who Saved Hollywood, and The Duelist was his last dubbing editor position in 1977. Then he went into editing. His first credit, The Sentinel from 1977, Watership Down, Alien, as we mentioned, The Awakening, Chariots of Fire, Blade Runner, Yentl, Legend, FX, White of the Eye, Bullseye, wow, Not Without My Daughter, Alien 3, No Escape, GoldenEye, The Saint, U.S. Marshals, Entrapment, thanks for the laser scene in Entrapment, The Musketeer, The Core, and his last credit from 2004, Phantom of the Opera. So thank you, Terry Rawlings. Okay, we're going to dip into the archives a little bit. Jed Bryan, who is the producer and director and writer and actor of the 2013 thriller Unlisted Owner, it comes out on Blu-ray next week. My apologies, that's why I'm playing this. So Unlisted Owner gets a Blu-ray release next week. Here is my chat with Jed Bryan. When artists create, whether it's a play or an album or a film, there's some autobiographical background behind it. I'm hesitant to ask you that, but where did your inspiration begin for Unlisted Owner?
Well, for the longest time, I've been a lifelong horror fan. My parents used to take me and my brother to the haunted houses in Evansville, Indiana, and my mom had actually bought me some VHS tapes as a kid of A House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price, the monster movie King Kong versus Godzilla, and always had an interest in horror. But it wasn't until I got into high school and I actually saw the Hostel film by Eli Roth that really got me interested in real life horror and just got me thinking, wow, there's something else out there besides, Jason and Freddy and the typical, monster movies. I mean, there's stuff of, realism that can really scare people. So I started getting ideas of what would scare me and putting them in the script form. And that's kind of how we started to go down the road towards Unlisted Owner.
So there is some autobiographical aspect. I didn't mean this to turn into a therapy session, but, that's fascinating. So, now for those who don't know, I guess, tell the folks a little bit of the story of the film.
Yeah, Unlisted Owner is a feature-length found footage horror film, and for people who don't know what found footage is, it's kind of shot in like a guerrilla style, or you're supposed to try to portray it as events that really happened. In Unlisted Owner's case, it is evidence that's been collected by the fictional Lawford County Sheriff's Department and edited into crime scene evidence. Basically, the film follows a group of friends who hear about a family of five that is murdered in a house about a mile away from where they're planning to camp at for the night. And they actually go to the house, and there's police cars and ambulances there, and they're pulling a body out. And they decide that they're still going to go on their camping trip, but through a series of bad decisions, they end up back at the house after their curiosity gets perked, and that's when all the fun begins.
Well, yes, I think the term is horror movie decisions at times have to be made.
Yes, exactly.
Now, of course, found footage kind of became a subgenre because of the Blair Witch Project, and there's been a number of them from paranormal to, you know, all the others. But you have a particular spin on the concept of found footage. Where did that come about? And tell folks what it is.
Yeah, I decided to make it like edited as crime scene evidence. I hadn't really seen that in a found footage film before, and I kind of wanted to give it that realistic aspect to it. And another reason we decided to go that route too was we put these evidence placards so people can know who has the camera. I know there's several other found footage films where you're jumping back and forth between different cameras, and you're kind of like not sure who's holding the camera or what point of view I'm looking at. So we put these evidence placards in there to kind of better help people understand who has control of the camera at that point in time in the story. We also did a series of blend edits to be able to make shorter scenes. Usually in found footage, the people who control the camera, they do these hard edits where it stops and it may jump like 5 minutes ahead or 30 seconds ahead. So I wanted to kind of eliminate that as much as I could. So we did a lot of scenes to where it looks like they go on forever, but there's actually like four or five edits within those takes. And actually there's some scenes that look like, well, it's just seamless, but it was like 3 or 4 months in between shooting.
I know other examples of that is like Alfred Hitchcock's Rope or Birdman, where you find little areas that you can do that splice that you know where it is, and if you're a big movie nerd like this host, you can find them. But for the general audience, it flows.
Yeah, one cool aspect in the film, there's an attic space scene in the film, which you've seen, and the house actually did not have an attic space in it, so we actually had to build a set to mimic the room in the house. So we basically had a fake room to the specs of the real room to be able to get that shot. And within that, I think it's like a 15-second scene. There's like six or seven edits in that one scene there.
Nice. The other thing I was thinking of, and you mentioned the different cameras, there's a little bit of Rashomon to the storytelling. And yeah, I just dropped Rashomon on a horror film shot in the Midwest. Deal with it. When you were working on the script, do you have that outline as far as let's use this camera, let's use that camera?
Yeah. I kind of wanted to show different points of view in the story. Like we had the police dash cam, we have the interview with Tanner, and then we have Jed and Griffin, who are kind of the main characters that you go back and forth between the cameras on. So yeah, I kind of always had that in my mind to be able to go back and forth to do that.
Okay. And, of course, you did everything on this. I think catering as well.
I have a lot of hats.
I have to ask, was that your band?
It was.
Just ask it.
I mean, I'll tell you what, it was a surreal experience, that's for sure. It got to the point to where, you know, I always wanted to make a movie, and the only way I was going to be able to get it made, especially in the small town of Sumner where I live, that I was going to have to do a lot of different things. So I just went ahead and just jumped in head first and just decided to roll the dice and see what happens.
Well, okay, so you're talking about your hometown, I'm going to just put, did you get permits? Did the town know you were doing this?
Well, actually, yeah, they did. I'm actually on the volunteer fire department.
Ah.
I'm on the city council now as well. But, yeah, so I got a lot of irons in the fire right now. But, But yeah, they were very much aware of it, and I had the support of the local police department, local fire department. Actually, everybody in the film who were first responders are actual first responders in real life. So, yeah, so that kind of has a little bit of a hint of realism in it as well.
I was going to say, when I saw the trucks, I was like, ooh, production value. What'd you have to get for that?
Yep, yep, just asked, just made a phone call and asked. And actually, my mom is good friends with the coroner, so I was able to get a body bag and, you know, all that stuff. So it really added a lot of realism to the film, for sure.
And there's nothing wrong with beg, borrow, and steal for your art. That's all right.
That's right.
Now, because you also directed this and was acting in it, it's one thing to, and I'm always curious about this, as far as, you know, having the camera set up so you can be in front of it, even though you're also direct, quote unquote, directing behind it. But because it's a found footage, how much emphasis or importance was there of using the movie term hitting the mark?
It's really difficult, especially in a found footage setting. I had an assistant director. How we ended up doing this was I had a digital transmitter on the camera, and my assistant director would be in another room. And whenever I would do a scene, I'd be trying to listen to the dialogue to make sure it flowed the way that I had wanted it and the way it was in the script. And he would be in the other room kind of watching how I was moving the camera. And every time I'd say cut, I'd immediately go back to him and say, okay, so what do you think? And he'd say, oh, I loved how you, you know, how everybody was in focus, or, you know, I liked how you concentrated on this. Why don't you do that next time? Just do a little bit more, stuff like that. And he kind of shared the same vision as me. So that really, really helped a lot to be able to have an assistant director, another set of eyes on it, because looking through that little bitty viewfinder on a camera can be kind of tedious sometimes.
I wondered if, and did you draw out anything ahead of time for this?
You mean as far as storyboarding?
Storyboarding,
and stuff?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, for
okay.
Sure, yeah. There were some key scenes in the film. I'm trying to think, the ending sequence.
Yeah, I don't want to give away a whole lot, but there's a couple of moments where I thought that's got to be boarded, because there's a couple of, spoiler alert on a horror film, there's a couple of jump moments that are very effective.
Yeah, we have, because storyboarding is very important. I mean, there's some people out there that make films like, oh, I don't really want a storyboard, but I wanted to make sure that my cast and crew knew kind of the same vision that I was wanting for the scene, to kind of help it, you know, go better, and for them to be able to understand what I was wanting.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come find the house? Because we all know the house is also a character.
Yes, for sure. Whenever the house is actually in Sumner, Illinois, the town I live in, and when I was a kid, I always thought it was such a fascinating house, such a creepy-looking house, for sure. Had a lot of character to it, and I always had in the back of my mind, like, wow, that'd be such a cool house to, you know, have a scary movie in, or, you know, have a haunted house in. And whenever I was writing Unlisted Owner, I had that house in mind, and the guy who owned it at the time was gracious enough to let us use it because no one was living in it at the time, so it worked out great.
And when you first went in, were you, as far as testing the rooms, did you do camera tests to see how it could go from one level to another?
Well, I'd actually been in it one other time when I was a kid, so I kind of knew the layout, and I also kind of wrote that into the script, because the house is huge. It's like a three-story house with mm-hmm. a full basement. So the only part I think I hadn't been in was like the basement part and maybe the very, very upstairs. But I knew that it was a big enough house that I could, you know, have a little bit more creative control as far as different rooms, different things happening and stuff, because I knew there was a lot of rooms in the house.
Okay. And shifting gears a little bit, how was any of the film improvised with the actors?
There were a few scenes that I'd always let them have a little bit of creative control. Whenever I wrote the script, I had all the main cast sit around and we did a round table read of the whole entire script. And whenever you're writing a script and you kind of know who's going to play the parts, because my friends were pretty much the main cast, and your friends have different mannerisms, different ways they convey things and different things they like to say, different words they like to use a lot. So I wrote that into the script, and also I used their first names. So that kind of helped with the flow a little bit too. But when we did the roundtable read, like I let them say, well, you know, I'd let them if they thought their character wasn't going to say that. I'd say, okay, well, you know, tell me what you would like it to say, and we'd change it and stuff. And I mean, we had a few things that we added in here and there. So, but for the most part, you know, when you go back and look at the script, I mean, it's pretty much, you know, the flow is exactly how I had it.
Yeah, I saw the cast list, and I kept thinking of the story Tony Danza said. He always played characters named Tony because if they called him something else, he wouldn't turn around.
Yeah, I figured it because everybody in the film, it was actually their first time acting in a movie. So, I mean, I think people had done plays and stuff like that. For the most part, most of us were pretty green to it. So I wanted to kind of make it as easy as possible and be able to use everybody's first name instead of like, hey, Steve, and they, you know, make it kind of awkward, just kind of let the flow go.
Right. So looking at the timeline, was this shot on weekends?
Yeah, it was. We basically, you said it was shot on weekends, right? Sorry about that.
Yeah, because I noticed, because for folks, there's about it took a 2-year span to complete, correct?
Yeah. We basically shot on the weekends. Everybody had full-time jobs and stuff, and the scheduling was kind of hard. I had a buddy, well, actually Tyler's in the film. He's actually a police officer at the time, which is kind of funny. And he was working like every weekend or like 1 day a weekend. And then Andrea, she was like working every other weekend. So trying to get them in the same scene was kind of difficult sometimes. But we were able to get it. That's the main thing.
And that's got to be hard because not just because of the time and the commitment of others, but also the continuity aspect.
Yeah, for sure. We did have an issue with continuity. There was a scene that after we filmed it, I put it into the editor and realized there was a huge mistake in it, and I needed to reshoot it. And a few months had went by this time, and when I finally got everybody together to shoot it, I think Heidi didn't have her overshirt any longer. Griffin didn't have his glasses because he doesn't really wear glasses, and kind of a pain, especially to find a woman's shirt. Happened to go around to all these different stores saying, I need this shirt. Can you guys have something similar to this? I mean, it's a lot harder than what you would think to try to find something like that.
And how was cast morale as you were going through these weekend shoots?
Oh, we had a blast. I mean, we look back on it now, and I talked to the different people who were in the film, and they look back as like, it's almost like a coming of age movie, especially for us. Tyler, he's married and has kids now. I'm married, have a kid on the way. So, I mean, it was kind of like, you know, like us being youthful and having, you know, instead of like, you know, kind of going to the transition of adulthood. So, I mean, it was, you know, we had a blast the whole time. We were always laughing and joking. And, you know, if you get the DVD, you can see the behind the scenes and you're like, wow, how the heck did he make this thing with all this joking around going on?
Now, yeah, I read that I know you had a couple of screenings in Indiana in 2013, and then there was another one with the American Film Market in 2015. Were there any changes that happened because of the focus groups and because of those screenings?
Yeah, actually there was. In 2013, the first focus group showing we did was in Vincennes, Indiana, and we showed it twice. We had 110 people each night, and I passed out surveys. And one of the main things people were wanting to know was about the family of five who moved into the house. So after reading all the feedback, I decided to go back in and I wrote a new beginning sequence to the film because the film originally started with just me, Tyler, and Gavin loading up the vehicle for the camping trip. So I have actually casted some people locally in the area, and we shot the original family of five scene. That's the beginning sequence to the film, which I think really, really helps set the tone for the movie.
And how did the when did you find out that you were going to be released on Amazon?
We went to the American Film Market, and submitted screeners to all these different distribution companies. And after we signed our deal with Tomcat Films, Summerhill Films out of Phoenix, they gave us a list of deliverables. And one of the deliverables was basically to create an M&E track for the film. And I'm not sure if you know what an M&E track is, but it's basically all the background sound separated from the dialogue, which a found footage film, it's kind of hard to have someone with a boom mic follow you around, so it's all recorded on the camera. Mm-hmm. So we basically had to recreate every sound effect for the entire 74-minute film, and that took us from February of 17 to July of 17. And once we got that complete, that's when we found out that it was going to be released November 14th on Amazon. So it was a long road for sure.
Can you watch found footage films anymore?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I haven't watched very many lately because I've been busy with the film and stuff. But I did play a found footage video game of Outlast. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or not, but it's actually like a game, and you have like a handheld camera, and it's a pretty neat game for sure. But that's probably the most recent found footage involved thing that I've done here lately.
Do you have another script in the works?
I have several scripts ready to go, even an unlisted owner too. But it just kind of depends on the funding we get from Unlisted Owner, depending on which direction we choose. I mean, I would love to shoot a traditionally shot film. The main reason we did found footage on this this time is because of funding. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll be able to make enough to be able to put to make a traditionally shot film next time.
And you said you have a child on the way?
Yes, I do. Yep.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Jace Bryan is going to be due May 30th.
And how old before you show Jace this film?
He may have to get a little bit bigger.
You think?
Yeah, I don't want to have to, you know, especially the wife might be mad having him have a nightmare, so I don't want to do that.
As the father of a 16-year-old, I can tell you, I will give you this parental advice. You can watch anything in the first year.
Okay, all right, awesome.
Because she has not, my daughter has not brought up watching The Wild Bunch. So I figured if she would have by now. So
yeah,
I would say the first year, although you might get what I like to use the term sitcom wife look. If so, you know, just but I think the first year you'll be OK.
All right. Awesome. I'll put that down.
And there you have it. My chat with director, producer, writer, actor Jed Bryan. His film Unlisted Owner is now available on Blu-ray. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Please go see Amazing Grace, and then you can see The Avengers. You know that's going to be around longer. Anyway, thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!